Hi, thanks for coming. We're going to try to do something interesting today, bringing all your great information and ideas to the forefront as well. And we thought what we'd do is we'd talk a little bit about what we do, meaning what kinds of three-dimensional challenges, what kinds of three-dimensional opportunities are actually available. I want to find out a little bit about the group here. How many people are from Cascadia? Okay, our new country. Who's not? Anybody here outside of Cascadia? Okay, where are you from?
Boston.
But that's a long way. Yeah, okay. We have a winner here at Boston. Anybody else? Yes, sir.
Southern California.
Okay, whereabouts?
Orange County area.
Okay.
Southern California.
Okay, Orange County.
County at
those okay, San Francisco. And yet.
Southern Ontario, Wisconsin.
Okay, great. Does that do it? And how many people are architects? And how many people are landscape architects? And I must tell you, I don't know the difference. how many people are planners? And again, I don't know the difference. And political elected officials, others, education? Okay. What did I miss?
Builder, developer.
Oh, great. Okay.
Engineers.
Good. I know about them. What kind of engineer?
Civil.
Okay.
Civil. There are some chairs in the front. I know.
Yeah. I studied under Howard Odom, who was an environmental engineer, but looked at things very differently than what most engineers were about. What I'd like to do is start off our challenge here, and then Rebecca's going to show us a little bit about the issues of global warming, climate change, and its impacts. And I think everybody here is well versed in the choir, so that we don't really need to spend a lot of time looking at how bad a job we're doing. And let's look more at the kinds of large-scale interventions that are not only necessary but essential. The basic belief here is that all of us, especially in the engineering, design, planning, development kind of phase, is that whatever we're doing, it's even though it's applaudable, it's obviously not enough. And we need to ask ourselves a question: is what is enough? Is that your dog? What is enough in terms of being able to actually make some kind of large-scale change? With that, Becky, you want to start off, and we're on our way to Alaska.
It just occurred to me, I don't know how to start. Let's try this.
Is it a film?
No, that's it.
And by the way, if you have questions, don't hesitate. I'm not waiting for a... We'll have a question and answer and work session at the end, but don't hesitate to ask.
Here we go.
Okay.
Bingo.
Excellent. I'm going to try to go through this fast, but I want to get as much information in your heads as I can. So if I go over something too quickly, please... Don't hesitate to ask a question. Or if you have a comment, anything would be much appreciated. This is the introductory slide, but I wanted to show you this symbol. And I need to stay near the microphone because it's being recorded. So I'm going to be pointing some, unless someone has a laser pointer, but that's okay. This is the Yupik symbol for... the Yupik culture is the north... The western, southwestern side of Alaska. Everybody has their hand symbol for their state. So this is Alaska. So the Aleutian Islands here. This is down where Juneau is, and this is the interior of Alaska. So this part of Alaska speaks the language of Yupik, and the Yupik, and I'm learning it right now in a university class. So that's, but this symbol, they don't, symbols in Yupik culture aren't translatable. You just look at them, and that's what it means. It means what your grandmother or grandfather told you it meant. It means in the places you've seen it before. So this is the Yupik symbol for everything that is. Kind of, you could translate it as the universe. And if you're an architect, you might think that those four spokes are the cardinal directions, but they might be and they might not be. It's an ancient symbol. So that's where we're starting today. Oh, there is a laser sort of. Oh, yeah, there we go. Okay, that's better. So, Alaska, the red dots, the maroon dots, or the dots, are 184 villages. In Alaska, there are 213 officially organized Native Alaskan villages. This is the 184 of those that have documented problems with erosion. Native Alaskans are subsistence people. They live off of what they can gather and hunt. They don't have any agricultural crops. And so being close to water is one of the most important things. They also follow caribou and also berries and fruits from the tundra. Anyway, you can notice that the red dots are mostly located on these river sheds. This is the Yukon River, which comes out of Canada. And this river down here is the Kuskokwim River. And this entire region here is called the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. It's a river delta just like Louisiana. There's another example we'll look at. On this picture of Alaska in winter, you'll notice the brown areas in the middle of the state. That's because there are trees there. Out here on the YK Delta, it's open tundra, no trees. You can see the rivers here. Anchorage is right down here. Here is Mount Denali, Mount McKinley, the tallest peak in North America. And the Aleutian Chain comes out. Okay. This is a picture of a village. Villages have no roads, no infrastructure whatsoever, and no roads are connected to them. If you want to go to a village, you have to take a barge or fly, or a dog sled in the right season, or a snow machine, as it's called. I'm going to try to go quickly. All of the villages sit on a condition called permafrost, permanently frozen soil. You go down somewhere between 1 to 3 feet, and you'll hit ice. And that's the areas let me continue for a little bit. Here's the river that the village is located on, and here's the ocean, the Bering Sea. Most of the buildings sit right on the ground. Some of them are elevated on piles. The bigger buildings are elevated on piles because a building will melt the permafrost underneath it and then sink. So this is the FEMA best practices, what you need to do to qualify for insurance, for flood insurance, for example. And when we think about the issue of regional design, you have to think about these are the policies that underlie and sort of force people to develop along certain lines. So the idea is that these buildings should be located above the 100-year floodplain and above any storm surge wave effects from the ocean. So they're pretty much taller than the trees in this diagram. Okay. So here's a village. You'd have your main form of transportation sitting in. You wouldn't say it's a yard, but here's the river, the Kuskokwim River. These boys are waiting for the ice to clear so they can go fishing. Here's another boat. Ice fishing on the river is common. The river brings logs. So there are no trees. I showed you it was the open tundra. This is a steam bath. Makyuk is the word for it. The word for Saturday is also Makyuk, because the days of the week were imposed on this culture. The word for Sunday is the word for peragayum, and the word for Monday is the word for to move around, because on Sunday is the day of rest, the missionaries taught them, and Monday is the day when you can move around. So it's called pikyun. So here he's collecting, they collect the driftwood so they can have the steam bath. The Corps of Engineers, who I worked for 3 years and have some level of appreciation for the struggles that they go through as well in terms of governmental regulation, has brought in the only way to get construction, heavy earth-moving equipment to the villages by barge. So here's a piece of equipment on a barge. The equipment out here lasts about 3 years. It's an ocean environment, so it will just rust. Plus, it sits on a barge for like 30 days to get there, and sometimes it takes up to 30 days for the sea to calm down so the barge can land. If you've seen Deadliest Catch, you could probably appreciate the ocean conditions. So here they are fortifying the structural modifications to the shoreline to help it. This land is all permafrost, which is melting or being undercut. The reason for that, let's see, here's a picture of them fortifying the coast. They have large fall storms like hurricanes in October and November. But when the large fall storms have hit in the past, that area has been frozen. Big house-sized chunks of sea ice all up and down the coast, protecting that glacial silt from the pounding action of the waves. Well, the land, the ice is melting earlier every year. So, we'll come back to this in a moment. This is the village of Shishmaref. This is in 2004. Some of this started happening in 1999. A winter storm came in, the ice wasn't there to protect it, and it took out like 300 feet of shoreline and one street along the edge of the island and these buildings. Here is, after that, in 2005, this is in a village called Kivalina. The core, this is the cheapest form of coastal protection, is to, you just ship plastic bags and earth-moving equipment, and you fill the plastic bags with sand along the shoreline. This is about a $10 million project. It took a summer to build, and the very first storm of the year, that year, just went right through it. And this is the best engineering that there is available. It's that the power of the waves is not well understood. Here we go. 184 villages are experiencing either river erosion or coastal erosion. Uniclet, Golovin, Shishmaref again. Here is the Arctic pipe. This is a sort of a manhole, you might say, exposed. This year, the governor of Alaska convened a panel and heard from each of the villages about their requests for funding. This is the village of Shishmaref. They're one of the slides from their presentation. They're required to do a feasibility study for relocation, and one of the options that they have to consider is the possibility of not doing anything, of the state of Alaska not doing anything. So this is what their statement, their official statement about that was. Another slide of theirs said, Shishmaref, the people of Shishmaref were worth saving. Here is the village of Uniclet, and I've spelled it wrong, and I apologized, and I need to correct that. What they're doing is they've identified a site on a hill, and they have a master plan for a new community there. It's about 2 miles from the shore, and they're going to have to haul water in buckets from their water source, which is near the shore, to their new village location on the hill. Here are the, there is a little book published by the state of Alaska that has recommendations for the options for villages. And they've made it universal so people who don't speak English can understand it. So here are the three options that they've given in that book. It's amazing the little icons they can come up with. Okay, so here is the village of Newtok has accepted a relocation plan away from their site. They've picked a new site on this hillside here. This is their first barge of materials being delivered to that site at the bottom here, and they're offloading those materials, including, if you can see it on here, there's roof trusses. Not a traditional style of building, but these are Bureau of Indian Affairs HUD-funded houses. Three of them were the first ones installed. Their community plan that was done by an organization called Village Safe Water and planned around the well and the fact that they wanted gravity flow on most of their lines. Piped water and sewer was a request of the villages. If Anchorage has it, we want to have it. So, and they haven't, we haven't talked about what their other options are. So that's something that we're here to talk about today. I need to go back to the slides that I skipped, and then we'll go ahead. This is a worldwide problem. Here is the Yellow River Delta in China. These are rice paddies in here. Over the course of the last 100 years, this river has had three floods that have killed over 1 million people. And that's because of the high population of this region. But the river is changing and moving. This river is the Kuskokwim River that I talked about a little bit ago. Right now it's on permafrost, but it still moves quite a bit. But the Yellow River is the future of the Yukon and Kuskokwim Rivers. Because they're both on alluvial plains that are composed mainly of silt. Okay. So one more slide on this comparison. In the last 900 years, the Yellow River has changed course 26 times. That's sort of twice every 100 years, you could imagine, the river moving. Here is from 1980 era to 2020 years. The Yellow River, which is called the Yellow River because 40% of its weight is silt. So the color of the river is the color of the silt, which is yellow. This is a 20-mile extension out into the Yellow Sea from the deposits. Below here is a picture of a model of how the Kuskokwim River will change its course. Here's the Kuskokwim. So it's one of those rivers with lots of oxbows in it, and villages are located. They were originally very mobile, a nomadic culture, but settled when schools were built, when community infrastructure was developed, more of a Western style. Okay, regional ecology very quickly, and then I think we need to move on to the more important matters of ideas and talking about regions and understanding ecology of regions and how that can help us. It's so tempting to focus on individual problems and bluffs eroding. There are very dramatic pictures. You've seen some of them about this. But we won't solve the problem by looking at pictures like that for very long. They're important to see. Okay. This is the village of Shishmaref has built a snow fence around basically a membrane. The snow fence causes snow to form a drift in this area, and it melts, so in the summer it is their fresh water supply. That was an infrastructure element that is their fresh water supply during the summer, but that is making it hard for them to relocate their village. Oh, this, you can see this is sort of a swimming pool membrane, it's just basically a waterproof tarp on the ground. This whole region, the western side of Alaska, has a tremendous wind resource. I forget if it's class 5 or class 7, but the highest sustained wind on the chart. In fact, these turbines are designed to turn sideways, parallel to the wind, at 60 miles an hour, and because beyond that, they'll sort of rotate themselves apart. And that's the problem that Alaska has more than not enough wind, is sometimes in some locations the turbine is actually parallel to the wind so often. But in most regions, wind is very... Now, this costs about $400,000, and to run a village, it would take about 30 of them. Now, these are... And the reason why the prices are so high is because of getting the crane, mobilizing the crane. And they have to... if these go out of plane by as much as half an inch, they can start to... sort of rotate themselves apart as well. So they're built in silt, you know, 400 feet of glacial silt until you get anything solid. So the construction costs are massive. Salmon is a huge resource for this region. There's no question about it. And other than a food source, it's pretty untapped. There has been some discussions about using fish oil. And traditionally, the natives use seal oil. They have little seal oil lamps for heat and for light. The Yukon River brings vast, vast fields of driftwood down the river, especially in a storm event. The infrastructure of the region is all small scale. So, for example, this road is an ATV, hardened ATV trail. Everything is transported by ATVs. So one of the things we're looking at and considering is if the villages need to be located near their food sources, near their subsistence supplies of seal, whale, salmon, the rivers are their transportation networks in the winter. They snow machine right on the river. But the rivers are on alluvial plains where insurance companies, laws, and best practices would say, don't build there. Then how can we find a compromise or design a solution that will be insurable or represent low risk to the government, provide health, safety, and welfare for the citizens of the villages? And also meet their requirements for a food source. So, I mean, we've been looking into these are machines that groom ski slopes, but they also happen to work on tundra because they have a low pressure. Their pressure on the snow or on the ground is pretty low. Same with the tundra condition. So they could be used to haul structures. These are examples from mountain villages, mountain huts they're called in the Alps, structures that were built for precarious structural situations that you might think could be relocatable. We're looking everywhere for examples of things could be adapted that have been used in other places. I haven't yet been able to find an example of a village on an alluvial plain that you could sort of pick up and move it. This is another example of a deconstructible building. And these, of course, this is an eco-village in Norway, the Buckminster Fuller geodesic dome. That's a sort of a laughable idea if you say it in Alaska. We'll put them all in geodesic domes. I mean, So here we go. This is a village. This is near the end, I think. Yeah. I didn't grow up in a native village. I'm not from a native village. So any solution has to be community-based, but we are the professionals. So they're looking for our help, and that's where we start today.